Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 9th of August. James Bartlett and Donald Steele are with us this hour. They have been working together as an important investigative reporting team for over 40 years now. For many of those years, they were at the Philadelphia Inquirer, then they were at Time Magazine, and now at Vanity Fair. They have won the Pulitzer Prize twice. They've won a number of other awards for their magazine pieces, newspaper pieces, and books. They are author of, I keep referring to this book because it was a very important one, the all-important book, Critical Condition, How Healthcare in America Became Big Business and Bad Medicine. The Great American Tax Dodge, they wrote America, Who Stole the Dream? America, Who Really Pays the Taxes? Forever Nuclear Waste in America? And now, The Betrayal to the American Dream. The book, they say in the prologue, is the story of how a small number of people in power have deliberately put in place policies that have enriched themselves while cutting the ground out from underneath America's greatest asset, its middle class. What I found important about their work is that they have, and these stories stay with you, of people who had fairly good-paying jobs, and certainly the jobs in some of these communities were the lifeblood of the entire community, and what happened to people and what happened to communities when jobs went primarily to China. And of course, the other story is why they went to China and why it is that all of this is happening and the profound effect that it's having on the middle class of this country. So I think they're going to get more than their share of phone calls this hour. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. You can leave comments there as well. Jim Steele, hello.
Hello, Kathleen.
Thank you for being with us again.
Nice to be with you.
And Don Bartlett, thank you so much for being with us.
Good to be with you again, Kathleen.
Yeah, well, you gentlemen have done it again. I must say, and I said it in the intro, one of the things that stays with me in the book, other than your astounding statistics about all of the taxes and all of that, are the stories of the human beings who have been affected by this. You know, living the American dream, living the American ethic, hard work, really hard work, not making all that much money, thinking you're going to be able to have a job. And holy cow, what's happened to so many people in this country who've lost everything?
You're so right, Kathleen, and that's exactly what struck us in our interviews with people around the country. And what Don and I almost do in all our work, it's a mixture of profiles of people, but a lot of data, a lot of statistics that show that what people are reading about isn't just some anecdotal example of some poor person who fell on hard times. I mean, most of these are broad trends that are going on in society. And the point you raised about the people really hit home with us as we were doing this work, because a lot of the criticism about what's going on in America, they say, well, we got this high-priced American labor, and that's why jobs are going offshore to stay competitive in the global economy. One of the stories we relate in the book is of a small plant in a little town in Missouri, not unlike plants in many parts of Wisconsin. I mean, it's the same kind of thing where the plant is kind of the heart and soul of a town of 10 or 15,000 people. They were making, it was a piecework factory. They were a subcontractor for Hallmark cards. And they were just making the cards and attaching to them ribbons and thread and other kinds of things you had to do by hand. The woman I talked to had worked there almost 20 years, and she was basically the number two or three person. What was she making? She wasn't even making $35,000 a year. And this is someone who's worked there 20 years. I mean, she's a manager. The people on the floor, the production workers, were making $20,000 to $25,000. So all of this talk about these high-paid American jobs is just absolute malarkey when you look at that kind of data.
And I was struck by that story also, just because I'd like for the audience to hear some of these stories about these people and what's happened in these towns. The story of Vice Grip was really one that stayed with me.
It really stayed with us, because Vice Grip is one of those products in America that I suspect almost everybody has one of those, even if you're not particularly handy. It's such a great device to have around the house. To remove bolts and so forth. But this This wrench was invented back in the 1920s by a Danish immigrant, and in the middle of Nebraska, in a very small town there, a town that never even had 1,000 people in its population. He invented it, began selling it out of the trunk of his car. It caught on. He began hiring local townspeople, others from around, and generations after generations after generations, that tool was produced and exported, by the way, to the world. Before we started talking about the need for exports in this country, that little company in the middle of Nebraska was really on the cutting edge. They were shipping these things all over the world. They shipped them to the British during World War II, helped with the, keeping their planes in proper maintenance and shape so they could go after the Germans. So what a record of this company. It provided jobs generation after generation for people. The company stayed with the times until eventually it was sold at some point when family members at some point decided to do this. It went into the hands of a multinational corporation, which then proceeded to gut the thing domestically and within just a few years ship that product to southern China to be made. And that, you know, the point about this story was for generations, this is the way we used to do things in this country. Somebody invented something, somebody designed it, somebody made it here, somebody sold it here, people bought it here. You had a nice cycle of work and economic activity going on. And all to unfortunately, in these days now, all of that's being disrupted. We aren't even making those things anymore. We're just automatically shifting the work offshore.
Mm-hmm. And there's story after story about that, and I'm sure people are living that and will call in. Don, what policies were put in place in this country that allowed VisGrip to go to China, that allowed Apple to employ so many people in China and in the horrible working conditions? What happened at the top to allow all of that? Why did it happen?
Let's answer the Apple question first. I mean, VisGrip provides a really nice counterpoint to Apple, because that was the tradition in this country. You invented something, you produced it for decades. Steve Jobs was in his obits was usually compared with Edison, Thomas Edison, the inventor of the light bulb. There were light bulb manufacturing plants all over this country for decades. The manufacturing stayed right here, but Apple, in this case Jobs, moved Apple out of the United States as soon as he could. He was gone, and you know, they put profits ahead of people. They put profits ahead of the country. And it was a decision they made in order to fatten the bottom line, pure and simple. No other reason.
And we had policies in place that encouraged this because, and this has been very much the multinational corporations. In other words, there are federal policies that let somebody go abroad, keep a lot of the profits abroad without being taxed. And then secondly, you can bring that product back in duty-free or with a very small duty. I mean, how can any domestic manufacturer compete? It's not just cheap labor in China. I mean, but they provide free land. They provide loans. They provide a whole basket load of things to encourage economic activity over there.
Mm-hmm.
No environmental laws, no labor laws to speak of anything. And just by saying that, I'm not saying we should get rid of our environmental laws. I mean, we shouldn't. But the point being, if companies over here have to abide by certain things, how in the world are they going to compete with a product made under those conditions on which basically no duty or tax is imposed? It's absolutely
right.
Impossible.
I know that you were the gentleman who broke this story about Apple in China, and there was talk after this, well, things are going to improve as a result of this. We're sorry, we're going to make things better. Have things become better?
I think we're just going to have to wait and see what happens there. There has been a tremendous amount of publicity. Apple has pledged in the past that they would make things better over there. The working conditions in China may, in fact, get a little better. The ones we related were, which have just astonished people in the book, you had workers at some of these plants run by Apple subcontractors who became so depressed by overwork, by the kind of regimen that their bosses imposed, that they were committing suicide. They were jumping off their college-like dormitories where most of them were housed and killing themselves. And this response, the initial response of the subcontractor for Apple, was to string nets around the bottom of these buildings, so anybody who jumped off would land in a net, not kill themselves.
So, that may be the most telling example of all, what life is like in China.
It just chills me.
And so we'll have to wait and see on that. But the main the issue, let's just say even the working conditions improve, you still got other issues in China that make it very difficult for companies over here to compete. And that is the Chinese governments, both at the national level and the provincial level, provide huge subsidies to companies. And some of them even round up the labor forces to stock some of these factories. I mean, it's very difficult when you're competing with somebody who's playing by a whole different set of rules that doesn't even follow the normal sort of rules of free trade. That's very hard to compete against.
Yeah. Well, you've got both Democrats and Republicans who have held the highest office in the land. You've had control from two political parties. You've had both parties, really, promoting NAFTA, free trade policies. I'm wondering what's happened to political attention to companies like ViceGrip, to companies like Rubbermaid in Ohio, to the loss of these kinds of well-paying jobs, or at least family-supporting jobs, for lots of people. Multiply these stories in companies all over the country. People have to get retrained. They lose their jobs. Some of them have committed suicide because they didn't have any place to go. Who's on watch here? Who's
nobody.
Not? Who's looking at these stories?
Nobody's a short answer. And there's a reason for that. We didn't realize this until we got into the tail end of the research, but there's been and the hedge fund people have been circulating internal documents for the last several years that they say flat out that the middle class in the United States no longer counts. It's irrelevant because they're going to make their money from the middle class in China, the middle class in India, the middle class in Brazil, and the other growing economies. So the American middle class just doesn't count anymore. People like to think that, well, they really need the middle class to buy their products. That's not true anymore. And you see this time and time again with the steps that are being taken to marginalize the middle class in this country. That's why it's a kind of a really pessimistic profile of where middle America is heading. But we made this point 20 years ago in America, What Went Wrong, which this really kind of updates. And we warned at the time, you could see the handwriting on the wall, that the middle class in this country was going to be in trouble. But nobody really cared in Washington. Washington now has signed on to the hedge fund philosophy that the middle class doesn't count. Now, they count in an election, but they'll say anything to get elected. And when they're elected, they will do the bidding of the hedge fund people and the financial aristocracy, basically.
Yeah. You cite so many astounding figures. 85,000 pension plans eliminated since 1985. 85,000. Who knows that?
Absolutely. And you know what? The point we make in the book is the contrast between that and the way things used to be for years. And a lot of really young people have no idea this. In the 50s, 60s, 70s, really up until 80. More and more pension funds were created that provided a guaranteed lifetime benefit if you worked at some place for a period of time. But then, all of a sudden, it begins to change. And the reason it changed was because corporations realized they could save a lot of money by no longer contributing to pension funds, freezing them perhaps, urging people to go into 401k accounts, let you manage your own pension funds. They were able to contribute less. They were able to shift the responsibility over to the employees. And initially, 401ks were never supposed to be pension funds. They were never supposed to be retirement accounts. They were always envisioned in the beginning as a supplement for your retirement. But to be the principal way people would take care of themselves in retirement was not envisioned at all. It was only after large corporations saw the money they could save and how they could shift that responsibility out of their domain that they then began treating these as pension plans, and Congress willingly went right along and for years adopted various rules, regulations, and so forth that encouraged this whole slide and stood by while company after company has canceled their pension plans. And what this means for the future is just really going to be devastating because not everybody had a pension plan. We know that. But the trend was going upward. The trend was more security. Now the trend is drastically going in the other direction, like so many of these other broad currents.
Yeah. There are no defined benefit pensions anymore, except those that were have been grandfathered in. Nobody's creating them in their businesses. They're gone. And as Jim, the point of the 401ks, they were designed for corporate executives to supplement their retirement plans. They weren't designed for ordinary workers. They were designed for corporate executives to hide their extra money.
We'll start taking phone calls in just one moment. Here's our number, 800-486-8655. Our guests are Donald Bartlett and James Steele, and their latest book is The Betrayal of the American Dream. We'll be with you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We welcome your phone calls now for Donald Bartlett and James Steele. Their book is The Betrayal of the American Dream. We start our calls with Jeff. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Joy. Before I give my comment, I want to thank you for taking my calls for the last 10 years. In 3 weeks, I'm moving back to Michigan to be with my grandchildren and where all the trees are just the right height. The only thing we need to remember is that capitalism requires the destruction of everything that gets in the way of profits. But the topic of this nation should be, how are we going to replace capitalism? Without unions, there's no middle class. You cannot have a middle class without unions. Goodbye, Wisconsin. Thank you.
All right, Jeff.
Well, this a very interesting comment. And one of the points we make in the book is that there used to be what we kind of call a social and economic balance in the country. You mm-hmm. always get arguments about some people thought taxes were too high and others thought the rich didn't pay enough and so forth. You're always going to get those kinds of arguments in every era. But in earlier times, there was more of a balance. The wealthy did pay more. We pumped more back into the economy. It's not to say that the deficit isn't important, but the point being, we reinvested in the country. We did some things. I mean, look at the Internet. I mean, this grew out of Defense Department appropriations. All kinds of things happened because we spent money, because we reinvested in the country. And the other point we make in the book is the greatest peacetime program that created jobs and had a tremendous spinoff effect happened under a Republican administration, Dwight Eisenhower in the late 50s, the Interstate Highway Program. Broad bipartisan support. I mean, can you imagine these people in Congress today getting together on anything significant to spend money? I mean, the whole issue is cut, 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 cut. And we make the point in the book that deficit reduction will not create one job. We're not saying the deficit isn't important, but right now we got a crisis out there. The middle class is really hurting. This country is hurting. We've got to figure out a way to get this economy going again, not just in the immediate sphere, but to start creating really good-paying jobs that will last.
Yeah, Don, who has all the money? All of these cost-cutting things, companies moving. There are some people who are really bringing in a lot of money. Who has it, and what the heck are they doing with it?
Well, it flows into this, what I had mentioned earlier, with the hedge fund types and private equity types. They are just amassing these amazing, amazing fortunes. And it's a global economy, absolutely, and the wealth is being distributed among those people globally. The point on they don't care about the middle class here because there are middle classes everywhere. The people at the top are also interchangeable. They live everywhere the rich people live. I give you it's a nice illustration. AIG, which was hugely responsible for the collapse, the most recent collapse, which cost middle class their homes, their savings, their investments. AIG brought in, after the collapse, a new person to run it, Robert Ben Mosch. He had been with one of the old line insurance companies and was retired. And a few months ago, it's been about 2 or 3 months now, he issued this pronouncement from his retirement home on the Adriatic, in which he said people are going to have to learn to work until they are 70 or 80.
Mm.
Now, the fact of the matter is, 50-year-old people can't find jobs today,
mm-hmm.
and there is no way in the world for a 70-year-old person, let alone an 80-year-old person. That's a joke. It is an and it's a very cruel joke. And the question is this the Republican Party's answer to creating their own death panels? Because these people will not have jobs, and they know that.
Yeah,
they absolutely know that.
Let's go to Mark in Milwaukee. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Good morning. Interesting show. I agree with much of what gets said, but in topics like this, a lot of the discussion tends to be anti-capitalism versus whatever sort of collectivism. And it's an argument that I think my side of the ledger loses, which is the collectivist side. And I tend to think lately about these topics in terms of cash cow culture. And if you take a look at business, the reason I like the discussion is because it takes place in a business framework. And if we're talking about capitalism and the flow of finances, this is something that is, I think, in my opinion, a strong argument that's within the set of discussions that goes on in the hedge fund community. And that is that the country, the culture, gets treated as a cash cow. When it's young and it's growing, it's perfectly reasonable to invest, to educate people, to provide for their health so that you can feed the growth beast that capitalist economies feed on. But as you get to a full point where growth and the middle class is tapped out and they've leveraged everything they can on their homes and whatnot, the culture, and particularly the capital culture, tends to treat the economy as a cash cow. You milk all that you can. You don't invest. You don't reinvest. You don't build new roads. Why? Because there's going to be better growth in China, India, BRIC countries, wherever you want. And it's the type of philosophy or the type of question that these gentlemen with their technical skills are more able to investigate and document. The notion that if you parallel business concepts and how businesses are treated like cash cows, it seems to me that's what our entire society economically is being treated as, and it's an economic argument.
All right, let's go to Jim.
I think your description on the cash cow thing is absolutely perfect.
And, that's a really nice
It really dovetails with something Don said earlier about the way the hedge funders look at the middle class elsewhere rather than this country, because the growth, by virtue of just exactly what you're saying, is going to be less. So you figure out other ways to maximize your profits and do those kinds of things. I think, and that's kind of the point we make in the book, though. It's, you know, capitalism thrived very well in this country, and certainly it's thriving very well with capitalists now in the past. But again, unless we have some kind of a balance, I mean, what is going to happen to millions and millions and millions of people in this country? And that's our point. We're not dealing with what their future is going to be about, because the return on them, frankly, is a lot less than the return on those middle-class people in China and India. That's what bothers us. It's actually one of the main conclusions of the book, that all these folks with the money are looking elsewhere. The United States is just sort of another one of their customers, and not a very robust one mm-hmm. in some of these sectors.
Mm.
So let's go where we can really get a much better return.
You know, and the other thing is a phrase that you used to see all the time in the 50s, and that is that we had a mixed economy.
Yep.
Part of it was totally unregulated, totally free market. Part of it was lightly regulated, and part of it was heavily regulated by the government. So you had these various kind of islands within the economy, each serving its own purpose. Well, today you would be labeled a communist if you tried to suggest something like
mm-hmm.
that.
You know, at the risk of being overly dramatic, or alarming about this, I guess I've read a lot of your books, and you guys have been doing this work for a long, long time, and they're highly respected. You even say in the 40 years that you've been writing about issues that affect all of us, you have never been so concerned for the future of our country.
And I'll tell you what some ways this is about. Part of it is an outgrowth, not just of what we've seen from afar, watching the overall data and the overall statistics, but a lot of it is just grows out of a lot of the interviews we've had with people around the country. The thing that amazed us when we started talking to people, and we did a lot of the interviews, and we collaborated with a very interesting nonprofit investigative operation based at American University in Washington, D.C., to also assist with some of the research and with some of the interviews. And so we all shared each other's transcripts when we talked to people and so forth. But what we found was sometimes the most mild-mannered, soft-spoken, sort of unemotional people who had been hammered one way or another by this, when you really sort of drill down deep within them, would come out with some of the most really amazing statements that sort of reflect really what you're saying. I mean, people are really, really worried. They're really upset. I mean, that's what, like, one in Florida was a woman who headed up basically a 100-person operation for an international accounting and management firm. She had two college degrees, not just one. We're always talking about how everybody's got to be educated. Well, she was really educated. One day, turns out the whole department is essentially being jettisoned and shipped offshore. Her husband had a good job. She went back to one of her first loves, nursing, and she said, I'll be fine, even though our income is going to go way down. But I'm worried about other people in this department, not so lucky, don't have a spouse like that, not making as much money. At the end of this, asked her, well, where do you think this country's headed? And she said, well, we seem to be having an elite class and then a low class. And when we get down that road to where we seem to be headed, will the low class continue? And by low, she meant just everybody but the elite. Mm-hmm. Will the low class continue to tolerate that situation? She said, isn't that what provoked the American Revolution? Mm. Those kinds of quotes, variations of that, we heard all over the country, east to west, little towns in the Midwest. So people are really upset. And a lot of this, I think, we think comes through in the book, but it doesn't really penetrate a lot of the media that you see out there.
You're right. It just doesn't. I'm sorry, John.
No, it absolutely does not. And it certainly doesn't. It is not raised in the political dialogue in an election year. And it's absolutely scary because so much of what's said, and this is both parties, has nothing to do with the real problems out there. Everybody mouths the platitude, we need to create jobs. But if you wanted to create them, you would have another interstate highway program, an equivalent of it, right now. It would just be enacted immediately. That's not going to happen because everybody now is fixated on the budget deficit, which needs to be dealt with at some point in time, but not now. And people like Paul Ryan in your state know that, and that, this is what is so disturbing. They know that's a huge mistake, that they are in the pockets of that economic elite, and they're going to do what they are told.
We're missing that sentiment that woman in Florida expressed. I'm worried about other people.
I think it's out there, but it doesn't mushroom up into the public consciousness much. Mm-hmm. I think it was one of the biggest surprises that we had. Not surprises. I mean, we sort of felt things were rough, but it was one of the most interesting developments when one person after another began saying the American dream is over, it's imperiled, why isn't Washington listening? And this is people of all walks of life. I was visiting a veteran center down in Southwest Florida. These were veterans, all more recent wars, Afghanistan, Iraq, some from Vietnam, others Korea, some from the Gulf War. I mean, there was actually one fellow there who was a World War II veteran. He was obviously getting up there. But anyway, the whole spectrum of veterans, and one of the fellows who was in his low 70s was watching television one day when I was in there. And some people were jabbering away on the deficit in Washington. And he just, veins popped out on his neck, and he says, what is wrong with these people? They are talking about the things that are not really concerning us down here. We need to get things going again. And so even across these areas of where you might think people would be conservative, less emotional, less dramatic about the government. People are really upset, and hopefully some of that stuff will manifest itself in the election. But it's so difficult to, I guess, for people to spontaneously express that. But I'll tell you, the feeling's out there.
Yeah. Sharon in Hillsboro.
Hi. Yeah, what I've observed is while they were the shipping of jobs overseas was beginning, there was an active assault on any safety net programs or public assistance programs that provided a floor to the labor market,
mm-hmm.
that they wanted to get rid of any kind of floor, because then there's no bottom to where wages could drop.
Absolutely.
And the desperation of the workers. You know, people would do almost anything for a job because there was nothing else. And I notice now I've heard that, for instance, food stamps, for every dollar of food stamps spent, it generates $50 worth of middle-class wages in that community.
Don?
Well, you're going to hear now in the coming weeks just all this rhetoric against the food stamp program. Everybody wants to cut it. Everybody in Washington wants a cut. And what's interesting about that is this. Forever, the food stamps went to people who were either on welfare or were on the edge of the economic, you know, as close to the bottom as you could get. Now, today, a majority of the food stamps go to people who are employed, and they are working in low-wage jobs like at Walmart and can't survive on the wages. And this is really telling, because here are people who have jobs, and they can't make it. So if that isn't fixed, it's just hard to see where this is going.
Thanks, Sharon, very much for the call. Mary Ann in Delafield, hi.
Hello. Along the lines of the former caller, in terms of job replacement by many of these major companies who are stock-held companies, it seems as though they should be like 90% accountable, or whatever number you want to pick, to replace those displaced workers before they can take jobs overseas. And I'm sure some probably do have training programs, but that somehow they're, you know, we need to come down on these companies taking jobs overseas.
That's a really good point, but that's the problem. That's a function of Congress, and we have a totally dysfunctional Congress, and that's being polite, because basically Congress is in the pockets of the super rich, and they are going to do what they are told, and they're not going to do the things they should do, just like you said. One of the fun things, one of the few fun things anymore, is talking to people like yourself, and when you're interviewing people, just ordinary people, they see the solutions. But Washington does not want those solutions. And that's what's so it's so destructive.
Well, one example, just to add to what Don's saying, it illustrates the power of this money. I mean, people know about this generally, but there are a number of specific examples in the book. The hedge fund people, the private equity people, have one of the greatest tax gimmicks of all time, and it's a very complex one, but it allows them to pay a much lower rate on their salaries. Sometimes they earn millions of dollars a year by virtue of this loophole, and they pay 15% federal taxes, while down the street, somebody who might be a pharmaceutical salesman or a biochemist is paying a much higher rate on their higher earnings. Now, how do they do this? It's a loophole. It's a gimmick in the tax code. And about 3 years ago, in a much more open-minded Congress than the current one, there was an effort made to try to amend that, to make it right, so that they would pay at the proper rate. Doesn't sound exactly radical, does it? To just pay like what everybody else would be paying for this
money. No, it's not radical.
Anyway, the private equity industry ginned up a lobby, brought on board some really high-powered people, began to trot in out of Washington some of the most famous private equity people in the country, like Henry Kravis, Colbert, Kravis, and Roberts, sitting down with lawmakers about the dangers inherent in changing the law. In other words, I guess it was dangerous if his tax rate went from 15% on several million to 35%. Perhaps he would have to reduce the number of second homes he had from 6 to 4 or 5 or something like that. But the point is, that was a Congress more attuned to some of the problems in the country. And even that time, the money came into play, the lobby geared up, and that thing went nowhere.
Hmm.
So even when the Congress maybe is, in a way, attuned to something, genuine reform has been frustrated because of the money that goes into the process.
Hmm.
And part of that, you know, that money thing is really to mislead people into believing something that absolutely is not true. And you've seen this with the Tea Party people. And I just don't understand these people. Because everything they espouse is for the benefit, the ultimate benefit of the super rich. But they, for whatever reason, can't quite seem to understand that. Or maybe they do and they want to be the friends of the super rich. I don't know. But there is no valid reason for listening to anyone in the Tea Party in terms of the policies they have espoused, because they will just drive a final stake into the heart of the middle class,
mm.
even though they're middle class themselves.
Mm-hmm.
It just boggles the mind, and you think, this may be the greatest failure the American education system ever seen.
Yeah, we got a lot of failures going on, a lot of failure of thinking. One of the other things that strikes me about your deep work is, well, you gentlemen have been doing this seriously for a lot of years, so you have a historical perspective. But it's but when you have that perspective and you include in the book statistics that look at what the richest Americans paid in 1955 of their income in federal taxes, 51.2%. Now it's 16.6%. Corporate taxes in 52, 32% of the federal government's overall tax collections, now 7.9%. You can't look at the deficit, which may be a serious issue, without looking at what's happened with taxes in this country and the amount of money coming into the government. And yet somebody won't let us do that. Why don't we do that?
You are so right about that.
You're right. They won't allow it.
And that number is one of the ones that actually amazed us. And it just goes to the heart of why things are, why in part we have a deficit. The subject came up, you know, why are some middle-class people not seeing what some of the issues are? And one of them, frankly, is the propaganda. I mean, a lot of the money is not going in just to buying lawmakers or lining their re-election coffers. A lot of it is going into advertising to influence voters. And some of this is very slick.
Yes.
I mean, look at the Koch brothers, who we write about in the book.
Yes, you do.
They were very influential, of course, in the recent thing in Wisconsin. But they have targeted various key states. And in Pennsylvania, for example, it's been announced that they're going to put millions of dollars into an ad campaign to blame President Obama for the deficit. I mean, people will look at things differently, I mean, in terms of conservative, liberal, and so forth. And that's okay. Obama responsible for this deficit? I mean, one is he inherited an extremely weak economy, which meant there were fewer tax collections, which would contribute to the deficit, and a weakness that was not of his doing. You had all through the previous administration tax cuts, which have led to $700 billion in tax cuts for the very wealthy, which has gone straight into the deficit. And now folks who benefited from those $700 billion, the Koch brothers, are using some of their millions to pay for advertising to say that Obama is the cause of this. And a lot of middle-class people, I'm sure, will fall for that argument, even though it's not true because the advertising is so slick, it's so polished, and people will have trouble connecting those dots.
Right.
By the time the election's over.
And unfortunately, Kathleen, you know, there's been a tradition in this country of that kind of policy working, and where there was no better example of it there than in Wisconsin with Senator Joseph McCarthy, who convinced a lot of people that the real threat was communists under the bed.
Right. Let's go to Saeed in Green Bay. Hi, Saeed.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. This conversation is a bit imbalanced in that the middle class certainly has an enemy in those who manipulate the tax code not to pay their fair share. That, in fact, is how politicians in Washington stay in power, is by such manipulations of the tax code. But the other way they stay in power is by spending. And you guys are talking like deficits are inconsequential. Well, let me tell you, if you take 100% taxation of the upper 1% of income, you create about $600 billion of revenue, which is one-third, only one-third of the deficit. These deficits are consequential. They lead to unemployment. They're unsustainable, and fiscal responsibility is not a vice. It is a virtue. And if you don't believe that, look to Europe. Look to Greece. Look to Spain.
Well, let's also look at Europe, and let's look at Germany, for example, where the unemployment rate is substantially below the U.S. And one of the reasons the unemployment rate is lower in Germany is because they have spent money in this downturn. The federal government has. They have decided that rather than just unemployment benefits, they would direct money to going concerns so that they could keep people employed on the basis that once the economy returned to a certain kind of prosperity, that those people would have jobs and wouldn't have to retrain them, which is what happens in the United States after everybody gets laid off. So, yes, they've spent money. Our point is, we're not saying the deficits are inconsequential. We're saying in the short term, though, we need to get this country going again. And if you get the country going again, that deals in part with some of the deficit issues because you have more people paying taxes. But you cannot dispute the fact that taxes for the very wealthy in this country, I mean, think tank after think tank after think tank, our numbers, it's clear as a bell. The wealthy in this country do not pay taxes at the rate they once did.
And if
at
you
a
do
time,
that,
this country was much more prosperous than it is now.
And if you do that for decade after decade, which is what has been going on, you wind up with the deficit we have now. Absolutely, you can't impose the super rich can't bail it out now. But arguing that the deficit is the most important thing would be like arguing that the silverware in the Titanic had to be just right and forget about the hole in the bottom of the ship. Because if there are no jobs out there, it's going down, whether you're in balance or not.
What did we do at the beginning of World War II? Did we say, well, we're not going to spend this much on bombers. We're going to give you half the bombers you need. We're going to give you half the ships you need, because otherwise we're going to run up the deficit. We ran up a huge deficit in the war because it was viewed as an emergency, a crisis. We are saying this is a crisis. And if you get the country going again, if you start creating good-paying jobs, some of that problem will resolve itself.
We have a caller who wants to talk about World War II, actually. Glenn in Manitowoc. Hi.
Oh, Kathleen, once again, thanks for two fantastic back-to-back shows. Incredible. The people even farther forward, our deficits are usually created by blue-collar jobs such as mine that paid a good wage. Gone. We paid the bulk of the taxes. But what I wanted to talk about was tying in the previous show. What really defeated the fascist nationalist movement of World War II, kudos to all our people, of course, was this country's industrial capability. And this country no longer has that capability.
True.
A quote from Chairman Mao is, "The West is nothing but a paper tiger." I laughed when I read it, but guess what? Without the industrial capability, this country has no genuine strength, and going forward for the future generations, when another threat arises, good luck with that.
No, you're absolutely right. Absolutely right. And one of the probably the best illustration of that is we use in the book The Building of the Bay Bridge and Rebuilding of the Bay Bridge.
That's quite a story.
In which the steel was brought in, shipped in from China. And the argument was, well, we can't really do that anymore. And it was almost accurate, but the fact of the matter was there were two or three steel companies ready to band together and build a new plant just for that job. And now I suspect this is a self-fulfilling prophecy, and probably the next one will not be built in this country. They really will be accurate that we can't do it anymore. This goes beyond disgrace. This is almost treasonous. And you almost wish you had somebody in the Justice Department who could imagine with an imagination about prosecuting people in new ways.
The gentleman's comment about the industrial capability really is a good one. And actually, this is something more and more people in power actually are starting to get concerned about. And there have actually been some studies in this regard, because what does happen when some of the things that are so important for your defense program and so forth are made elsewhere, and you end up with that being disrupted for one reason or another. One of the few bright spots we've seen lately, and it's just almost happened really right around the time we were finishing up this book, is that more and more people are starting to think manufacturing maybe is a lot more important than I realized it was. I mean, you had a lot of these Harvard Business School people saying, I wish people stopped talking about manufacturing. It's like we're moved on beyond it. But now a lot of people, even in manufacturing, are saying it's very important for a whole range of things, because it's not just jobs, which is the way we look at it, but it's part of your whole system of innovation and experimentation. When you separate the manufacturing from the design, from the people who come up with these things,
yes,
you start
yes.
losing something.
Well, and you have instances in the book where we've had to send people to China to fix some of their mistakes.
That's exactly right. In the Vice Grip story, one of the fellows I talked to out there who'd been let go, they said, well, we'll keep you on for 2 or 3 months if we can send you to China and see if you can whip this operation in gear over there. And the thing that he was struck by is that all of these American economists are always talking about efficiency and productivity. Here he'd seen the plant in Nebraska, the Vice Grip plant,
right.
which was very modern in many ways. It'd done all kinds of things where thousands of tools were turned out in a day's time. Over in China, all they were doing was throwing bodies at the problem. And they were cheap bodies in terms of their labor costs. But that wasn't the answer. They were getting poor products, things that fell apart, things that were the exact opposite of the idea of efficiency. And I think that's what one of the things that's so frustrating to us. They're talking about the American worker. American worker is actually very efficient.
Mm-hmm. We're talking this hour of the program with Donald Bartlett and James Steele. Their latest book is The Betrayal of the American Dream. We'll have a couple more minutes of conversation and at least one more phone call in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we have time for maybe one or two calls. Mike in Milwaukee, hi.
Good morning, Kathleen. Thank you for the show. I was reading an article that was 2006, Derek Jensen, Beyond Hope. He says we need to forget about hope. It's hope that keeps us kind of chained up, and that we need to deal with despair, and that's when action will start to happen. The other thing is regarding steel and manufacturing the structure, beams and stuff that came from China for the Milwaukee County, for the stadium, for the Brewers here in Milwaukee, had to be all re-welded by Milwaukee welders because they were found to be structurally unsound. And I'm wondering if you could just comment quickly on not quickly as in-depth as you want to, but these trade negotiations that are happening, I believe, in England, and Obama seems to be all for it.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's a big part of the book, and we just didn't get to much of that.
Well, in general, administrations on both parties, almost all, the president in almost every case, embraces free trade agreements. And there just seems to be some manual out there that says don't under any circumstances raise questions about free trade because
right.
you'll get bombed. Mainly editorial writers around the country. I mean, the economists, there's this tape in the head, what we call the most economists, that free trade is good under any circumstances. And the point we raise in this book, there's nothing wrong with free trade per se if everybody practices it the same way, but not everybody practices it the same way. I mean, we have our doors open for almost everything. Most of the rest of the world doesn't operate that way. And until it does, we're going to be blocked in terms of getting some of our products abroad, which would create more jobs here. And it also means that others abroad who, under unfair conditions, subsidies and so forth, are able to send products over here that unfairly compete with our products. I mean, every couple of years, the United States Trade Representative's Office publishes a thick booklet of basically trade barriers around the world to U.S. products. I don't care who's in power, a Democrat, Republican, you know, that office is there year in and year out. And every year, they list these barriers. And every year, it's hundreds of pages long. And it never really changes. The nature of some of the barriers get altered a little bit. even Japan. I mean, nobody talks about Japan anymore. You ought to see the section on Japan in the trade barriers book. And nobody's happier about that, the fact we're pounding on the Chinese than the Japanese, because this is let them go about their business as usual, continue to have barriers to a lot of our products, and continue to ship their goods over here. But what we hope is at least people will start realizing the way we practice free trade is not working. And until we do that, we're not going to have a decent trade policy. We're going to continue to lose a lot of these jobs in manufacturing and now even the service jobs.
James and Donald, thank you so much for being with us. We're out of time. You've given us ideas for hundreds of talk shows.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you.
Always
thank
a pleasure so much, to be with you and your listeners.
Yeah, always a pleasure to have you with us. The book is The Betrayal of the American Dream. The authors Donald Bartlett and James Steele, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning for producing this program. I'll be with you again on Monday. Great conversations ahead on the Ideas Network.